Did you guys have to hit a pin?
Sure did.
Awesome. Okay.
Yep.
We're fully recorded. Is anyone else on the call? No, it's just the two of us.
Just the three of us?
It's just the three of us, yeah.
Wow, that's I don't know if I've ever had that.
I guess they scared everyone off. Did my email come through last night?
Yeah, I got it.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to make sure because I saw that Tamara had sent one too, which made me think, oh, I wonder if mine didn't go out. I feel like I don't get all the emails, and I don't know why that happened.
Yeah, I find that interesting as well.
I mean, sometimes someone will respond to something that's a big, long thing, and I'll say, oh, I didn't see the beginning of this whole strand. Well, I wanted to talk to you about education for sustainable development, too, so I'm glad you are here.
That's awesome.
It was like the cool thing for environmental ed for basically when I started grad school in environmental ed, it was like, oh, we're going to all do ESD now instead of EE. Well, not everyone. It was just sort of appointment. So it must have been right. I think it must have been right when that UN decade began.
Right.
But I have heard that, I mean, most people just sort of fell off on it, which were more in the line with what these people said in their article. I'd actually be interested to hear if Karen came on, or I'm sure she has more of a context for it.
Right.
But, yeah, it was sort of the cool new thing in environmental ed for that decade.
But I think one of the things that's interesting to build on Rachel's presentation from last week, were either of you able to be part of that?
I wasn't a part of it. It was so great. I wish I'd had more time to stay on the whole thing.
I'm sorry, Mr.
I really enjoyed it.
What's your name? I'm sorry, the intern from NCSC.
Oh, yeah, Kate.
Kate. Hey, Kate. So I actually followed up with Rachel, and I just earlier today had a long conversation with her about how to take what they've done and, you know, fill in some blanks that they were exploring and from some of the history piece, but see where could that go. But I think the thing that I find really encouraging about what that implies and is everybody keeps on focusing on pieces when really you need a full education kind of strategy to deal with the things that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Much bigger than EE or education for sustainability, because everybody's focusing on pieces. When it's the whole education system that needs to be brought on when you're doing systemic change, which is exactly what we're talking about, you know, to get a circular economy, to get a low-carbon future. I mean, these are monstrously huge things. And we can't have little pieces of education working on them. It's kind of the whole system.
Yeah, we need like the non-partial education field person to do that, because everyone gets they feel so much ownership of their realm and even the language in it, you know, like how we talk about the same things, but we use different words for them. And I think of my advisor in grad school was actually in the humanities, but then my committee was in the sciences and in sciences and rhetoric, but they didn't speak the same. We were all talking about the same things, but they didn't speak the same language, and they didn't see the relevance of each other's research tools, you know, in making understandings of things. But they were all working towards the same end. I mean, it was climate change education was my focus. And we were all focusing on, in the end, the same goal. And I even feel like, I mean, that was one of my big things I was trying to do, is like make it clear that the humanities has to offer and the way of looking at the world actually is really you know, is a part of it. And I was encouraged, actually, that she had mentioned humanities, because that's separate from social sciences even, you know.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. But who's the impartial understander of all languages and in education that doesn't feel like this affinity to a particular realm?
Well, you know, I mean, I think the one of the things that I spoke with, Kate, I don't know if you're familiar with the Climate Literacy Guide.
Actually, I am. Yeah.
So one of the things that Rachel and I, the presenter from last week, were talking about was the definition, which is something that really a lot of people jumped right into the learning objectives, the standards and the, you know, and all the essential principles and fundamental concepts, right? And they jumped right over the definition. And over the years,
Or the guiding principle.
You know, over the,
I mean, that's my favorite part.
Well, so actually this is something that we talked about, right? Because the guiding principle was a placeholder for the social science part of climate literacy, that we all knew that the people who were involved in the 2009 initiative were really physical and natural science communities. We weren't coming strongly from the social and humanities and other areas. And so that's why we called it climate literacy, but then inside it's called climate science literacy, because we knew we were only part of it. And the guiding principle was our best whack at the non-physical natural sciences part. But we knew that, you know, we're not experts at this, so that's why it's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
But the definition about, you know the stuff, which is really what was in the document, but not all of it, and then you are able to communicate about it in meaningful ways, understand credible sources, and make informed and responsible decisions.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the definition. But we kind of lose the focus on that piece, which, is, by the way, Kristen, this is a prelude to next week.
Oh,
for me.
Frank's giving a keynote at our institute next week, so he's practicing right now.
But it's a 10-year thing, right? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So, but it's interesting that something like that just popped right as we were, you know, preparing for this talk. But it's really interesting, you know.
Yeah. Well,
to think about where that can go.
Right, and I love. Personally, as someone who's more, I would say, I straddle the social and humanities and sciences more. The guiding principle for me is very open to interpretation, which I freely do. But I do think that that's okay. Like, I can do that because I'm actually like this. I'm like, think that there's validity in the social sciences and the humanities. But that's where the work that Rachel's doing is really important, to make it more explicit for those who don't necessarily make that connection or see the validity, to have it more fleshed out, you know? But as someone who's in it, I have always liked it because when people are saying, well, that's not in there, and I'm like, what about this right here? You can interpret to mean this, you know? That's in there. So.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, you know, just to maybe close out my part of this is that I am following up with Rachel and her team to see if we can build some kind of derivative framework to complement the climate and energy literacy frameworks, from a social science perspective. But probably we shouldn't stop there, because you have the other modalities of education or other disciplines that are actually critical to this, like the arts, humanities. This is an all disciplines, all education system, you know, level initiative. So, we're kind of picking it off piece by piece, but it's really the integration across them that is the most critical piece.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Cross-cutting concepts.
Yeah, but beyond the vision of the NRC, right, which is those cross-cutting concepts cross, it's really that, I think, you know, some of you have seen that, the Venn diagram that people use, where it's looking at the skills across ELA and math and science.
Yep.
And it's really the full, it's all the skills of a well-educated person. to be a citizen and a member of the workforce. That is what we're ultimately talking about,
mm-hmm.
which is the grand thing we're looking for. But I don't know who calls for that other than the community that has a relevant reason for it.
Right.
I think that's us.
Well, yeah, we do. And, like, Arne Duncan should, but I don't know that he's had much to say at all.
It's not really, he's kind of said some things, but I mean, you know, but it's not really all the way there. He doesn't
right.
get the stuff.
Right. Yeah, well, education reform, that's our next agenda. Oh, wait. No problem.
Well,
no problem.
Yeah. Well, you know. Hey, Kate, while you're with us, what do you, if you don't mind switching around,
yeah.
and maybe we can jump to your agenda item, Kristen.
I don't have any agenda item.
Oh, I thought you were talking about books.
Oh, I just suggested a topic, but
yeah.
No, I don't actually have any books. I haven't had time to read lately, so.
Gotcha. So, Kate, maybe you can just tell us who you are and what your focus or goal or background is?
Yeah, so like you said, I just graduated from U.S., and I studied when I was there. Actually, I really enjoyed the talk last week because it had a lot to do with what I studied in undergrad. I did political science and natural resource conservation, and within natural resource conservation, I focused mostly on, like, policy communication and education.
Cool.
So I loved it, and then I really sort of have this idea of the sort of all encompassing environmental education.
Did you work with Martha Monroe then?
Yes. Oh my gosh, I love Martha Monroe. She is my advisor, and I actually she told me about NCSC. So.
Oh, very cool. So did you work on the Pine Map project at all?
No. I was working with a specific middle school for, developing a Kids in the Woods program. But So I didn't work on Pine Map, but I've heard about it.
Some of their facilitators are coming up to our institute next week. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I worked a little bit with them on the as a education advisor, just as far as writing that curriculum. So
cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where are you located, and what
Minnesota.
Organization do you or?
Okay. Oh, I'm with Climate Generation.
All right.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, the Pine Map, is that at all? I mean, is that students taking measurements in you know, field locations? And sharing that with the, what is Pine Map?
So Pine Map is one piece of a larger. So Pine Map as a whole was I think it's a $10 million USDA project. Funded. Pine Map meaning Pine Integrated Network Education, Mitigation, and Adaptation. And it's through University of Florida and maybe Georgia. I think there was three universities on it. And it had these big aims. So they focused on modeling and ecology and genetics, economics, extension, and then education was one of the six aims of the project. And so what's cool about it, so the focus is on southeastern pine forest, plantation, and looking at carbon sequestration potential, and then increasing efficiency of nutrient cycling stuff. I think I'm entering a realm of things I don't know a ton about, but the education aim focused on creating a curriculum resource that focused on southeastern forests and climate change. And they worked with Project Learning Tree to make it actually a module of Project Learning Tree. But what was super cool about the project is they had all these other aims that were these scientists that were actually doing this research that were on this project team with them. And so there's all this really authentic research integrated into it. And there's videos that go along with that, like interviews the researchers. But it's a very classic like environmental ed curriculum that kind of looks at exploring the environment. It's very place-based, you know, exploring the environment there, looking at life cycle assessment as far as like the stuff that we use and where does it go. It was very research-based because they had, as I said, I mean, it was a $10 million project, so there's a lot of great outcomes. But it's published now, and it's out there. And so there'll be someone coming up to talk about that to the Institute.
Spectacular. Thank you.
Yeah. That's the nutshell. Yeah. Well, does anyone have any other topics they want to talk about? Or I'm sure we have other things to do today, too.
Well, I mean, one follow-up with the thing I was talking with Rachel about was, and also the thread that, you know, that German article, or that article about German schools and then Mark McCaffrey's follow-up, is that the, you know, signaling to the education systems that we're talking about an issue that cuts across all these domains or all these disciplines in a much more integrated way, which is in the spirit of the NGSS and the NRC framework, but it's bigger than that, right? Because it's not just science. I think that some of the stuff that's in the NGSS can't be done in just science by itself either. It actually has to get into other domains as well, so that this idea of integration, integrated learning, transdisciplinary integrated learning, you know, we do it a lot at the undergraduate and graduate level, but we really haven't cracked that nut in the K-12. In fact, probably the trend is going away from that with all the assessment and accountability stuff forcing that out, not in. So, you know, signaling that that's really important and the baby is out the window in the bathwater, it might be good to grab a toe and pull it back in. So,
yeah,
that's something to explore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm always surprised at the number. I still think there's hope and... I mean, middle school seems to be able to do more of the integration, and then, of course, elementary still. But, I mean, testing is even, you know, squeezed in there and is sort of pushing things out. But I'm always surprised at the number of teachers that are, like, fifth or sixth grade that come to our institutes. And it's just because this is something they're able to do. They can fit it in. It will make sense for them to talk about it during their, you know, science and in their social studies time and their art time. And, I mean, they just think that way. Their teachers think that way. You know, elementary teachers are able to actually think that way.
Well, there's a new document that came out of ACHIEVE. Let's see if I can pull it up. But it's calling for, like, basically you have to redesign the schools or the systems, education approaches from the ground up in order to really do this. Because you can't just tweak a lesson and call it good.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't work. It's a full approach. I'm wondering if there's something, if you're opening up that big can of worms somewhere, that you could deal with some of these aspects there. It's the PEAC, P-E-C alignment. I don't know what that stands for. It's the primary evaluation of essential criteria for alignment. PEAC, P-E-E-C.
P-E-E-C.
Is available. Yeah, P-E-E-C.
Huh.
But, I mean, they're really calling for something very large in this. Bigger than, you know, and they're saying that, you know, shifting school programs to support implementation of the NGSS will require many changes. The best response to this challenge would be to design brand new school science programs. you know, that's kind of what they're calling for. Not tweaks, but, you know, redesign the system altogether. And so maybe that some of the challenges we always struggle with high school can be dealt with in that redesign. It's a big vision kind of opportunity. We'll see if the states and districts take that on.
Yeah, I'm looking at these key innovations. Innovation one. Interesting. Yeah. It's interesting to follow this whole progression with this, how I feel it waning, which is disappointing to me. Because when it started, when NGSS came out, there was just this real, like, they really tried to explain. I mean, they were not doing a great job because they were too complicated, but they really were trying to explain what NGSS was, I feel like, in the beginning. They were trying to explain this three-dimensional piece. They were really emphasizing the three dimensions. They were talking about what you're talking about, how we need to rethink how this, how we have our whole science classes, you know, set up. Is there a progression? But I feel like it's already, there's always already some backing off going on, where we're saying, oh, well, you know, we're just going to focus on, if you can just focus on practices and
right.
Emphasize that piece and look at just that part, and we're just going to start there. But I don't know. Kind of like, go big or go home.
Well, you know, one of the things that was very interesting in a lot of the early conversations was that the people who are doing this work at the state and district level probably needed some serious leadership courses and leadership training to manage this process, because it's big. It's really, really big. And in order for that to happen, they're going to need, you know, the leaders of that process are going to need to be effective leaders. And not everybody is just naturally going to show up as a leader, but it is a skill that can be built. It was interesting to realize that they didn't see that, you know, a year before they started trying to do all this. And now, and also it's a very transient position for a lot of these people. And they, you know, they get in, and then the next person comes in, and they're, you know, so then the practicality comes in. Like, let's just figure out how to do something.
Right.
And that's what you're starting to hear.
Right,
because
exactly.
We have to do something. And so
well,
it doesn't surprise me.
It isn't. I'm really, one of the things, though, I find kind of heartening, and I think someone sent something out across a couple weeks ago, but how this is becoming, I mean, once again, we're getting into very local place-based, but like districts, the district adoption is becoming much more common now. And that, in some ways, seems so much more attainable, you know, because, I mean, in our state, it is a district-to-district. We have our state standards, but you can choose how you implement them. And so even if when we adopt in 2018, it'll still be a district-level decision as to how it's done.
Right.
So that's really interesting, and I'd like to hear more about, I can see that being like kind of like, duh, maybe that is really where it's at. We need to start looking at these case studies of the different districts.
I think that's where this is all going to go, and, you know, when you start doing an analysis for the issues that we tend to focus on, you know, you have to look at the populations and look at where the populations are, you know, or the vulnerabilities of populations are in order to focus. Because there are 15,000 school districts in the nation. I can't focus at 15,000. But LA Unified and New York City, I could focus there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I don't mean this in a political campaign way. I mean it in just an efficiency way.
Right.
And so, you know, if like one of the things we're hearing is that Austin and Denver school districts might move ahead of their states. And they're definitely, you know, it's just with Achieve leadership and the Board of Science Education at the NRC. And they're talking about, they know districts are moving out ahead. And, you know, they're basically okay with it because, I mean, what else? They had no other alternative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are doing it. And I think that that's, but the question is, are they doing it well? Are
right.
they really living up really to the spirit up. And the transformational potential of what's going on here for such important issues that we're facing? And that's an open question. So, you know, I think in California it's going to probably be, there are going to be some districts that do amazing things and others that are going to be laggards. And I think that's
yeah.
going to be true. I know it's true in Maryland.
That's where the resources are, too.
Yeah.
You know, to implement them, yeah. Yep.
You know. So I think, but, you know, crystallizing, catalyzing, telling the story of, you know, why this is an amazing thing to do, and it can be done really, I mean, even Mark alluded to that in Germany. Same phenomena, where you've got certain districts and different schools and systems that are doing amazing stuff with what we talk about. In other places, nah, not even close. So, you know. Anyway, it's, I think that's going to be true regardless of where you are. It's just, you know.
Right.
But, and that, so I think that, that idea of case studies is going to be true for international just as true as it's going to be for national or districts or, you know, whatever unit of population you want to use.
Yep.
So, Kate, what's your focus of your internship? I mean, what's your gravitated focus?
So for the most part, I'm working with Minda and starting a new teacher network with NCSC. I'm within that. I'm working on a Scientist in the Classroom program, in which we're trying to connect teachers who teach evolution and climate change with scientists who do research in those areas, and then create like a platform for them to form a relationship, and then get the scientists into the classroom to like do like experiments with the kids and like act as like an expert and a resource. So that's pretty much the focus for the summer.
Cool.
The teacher network idea is pretty interesting. The connecting scientists to classrooms, that's a big one. You know,
yeah.
That's hard. I've spent 10 years at NASA and 10 years at NOAA, and that is a very hard thing to do. But the network is,
yeah.
I think that's a lower apple on the tree.
Have you
exactly?
Have you talked to Susan Burr at all at Colorado? She did her last big project was connecting. She connected the scientists more via like webinar, but they were available for the teachers that were a part of her outreach education project.
Okay, no, I haven't, but I think that would
put
be
her
a
on
good
your
person.
Yeah, she's a good person to talk to about that, like what worked. And she's within the university system, and I know you guys partner a lot with UC Berkeley, but that worked.
Yeah, and we're looking to work with different like universities, like recent like grad school graduates and people doing their postdocs in terms of finding the scientists.
One other, Cindy Schmidt at UCAR has a project called Climate Voices. It's only on the climate side, but they've done a lot of training and identification of climate scientists who would be willing to give talks. And it's more public talks, but the same, you know, especially if you're doing remote engagement. I would imagine a subset of them are available and would be interested in what you're describing. So you might want to reach out to Cindy Schmidt at UCAR on the Climate Voices project and see if there's a collaboration there for you guys. I mean, you might get some efficiencies given all the work they've already done that, and a lot the cast of characters that are in that database that they've been working with these are some of the best. So you might be able to accelerate at least on the climate side.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you so much. Do you have her? Do you both have the email addresses of these people?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure it's on the Climate Voices website, but I can see if I can find it.
Oh, I can easily find it. That's actually pretty easy.
And yeah, Susan Burr, I'm sure. Minda has Susan's email, but I think it's Susan. Well, she's Susan Sullivan now. Susan.Sullivan, Sullivan, @colorado.edu. And I would look up the ICEE, Inspiring Climate Education Excellence Project.
Okay.
Project.
All right,
that's
great.
What she's a part of. Yeah, that's what it was a part of. Yep.
And so on Climate Voices, there's an about page and there's a contact link on the bottom. It's info@climatevoices.org is the email.
All right, great.
So I would highly encourage you to reach out to them.
Definitely. That'll make my job a little easier. And it would be good to use resources that are already built up.
Any efficiency you can get is a high value. Because there are, 54 million K-12 students and 20 million, higher education students. And just think about the amount of educators in classrooms in the 140,000 schools that are out there. It's a very large challenge. Any efficiency you can get is high value.
Exactly, yeah. Right now we're
right.
just,
cool.
Yeah, very exciting.
Cool. The network approach, do you have any boundaries on which kind of educators you're talking about? I mean, are you guys tend to think on the science educator side?
We're focusing on science educators. I actually, my background is a little bit more in the social sciences, so I'm kind of pushing to get maybe social studies or civics teachers involved as well. For the most part, science teachers, and at least for the scientists in the classroom engagement, we're looking to focus on middle and high school for the most part.
Right. That makes sense. But I think you're going to find that the teacher network, like we were talking about before, the teachers who are moving forward on the subject in classrooms now is well beyond the science classroom. The most active, the one other group you might want to talk to is the Alliance for Climate Education on that one, because the people who bring them into a school are are the champion for engaging students on climate change, and a lot of times that is not a science teacher.
Okay.
And
yeah.
So, it's another anecdotal bit of evidence that the educators who are connecting climate and their field are not just science teachers.
Yeah. And then that's something that because in my mind, I think that we should be teaching a little bit about climate change and the environmental world in an economics class and a lot in the government class and all
history
across the board. Yeah, exactly. In history, there's a lot of history there.
Just think about the Industrial Revolution. You would talk about the Industrial Revolution in a history class. And, that's a huge part of what we're dealing with right now.
Yeah. And then when you talk about a lot of times people only talk about... Oh, go ahead. Yeah, sorry.
No, you please finish what you're saying.
Oh, I was just going to say that, like, with the Industrial Revolution example, it'll be talked about in, like, an economic sense, but not necessarily the environmental implications, so.
Sure. Kristen, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, from the social studies aspect, too, there's a great, so you're familiar with the next-gen science standards, I'm sure, but then there's also the C3 framework, which is part of social studies. And there's an article, actually some people presented on it, I don't know, 9 months ago or so, but there's an article that looks at how the C3 framework fits with climate change, just as which is part of social studies. It's like their NGSS, essentially. That is also a great sort of argument for the place of climate in the social studies classroom.
Awesome.
That would be worth looking at.
Yeah. No, this is all great information. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, we have a huge network of teachers that we work with, and I will say that there's different parts. If you're setting up a network, I think you should, I mean, there's different kinds of pieces that you do research into, like what resources are out there to connect, what teachers are interested, but also just like what's the logistics of the whole deal, because it's once they get into their school year, it's very difficult to stay connected with teachers, I would say. Unless you're offering something to them that they're, like you're saying, like a scientist in the classroom or something, like that's pretty cool, or webinars, or, you know, a connecting piece throughout the year. But that's not to say that they're not doing the things that they learned about. And that's one of the most frustrating things for me is we have between 75 and 100 teachers that we work with every summer at our institute, and we connect with them throughout the year, but it's at least twice a year I'll maybe run into one, or I'll see someone somewhere, and they'll say, oh, I used, you know, your curriculum, and it was so great, and da-da-da-da, and I don't know a thing about that. I have never heard it, right. And I wish I'd been there to see it happen. And so there's sort of, when you're setting something up like that, just be aware of, like, what your capacity is to make it the best thing that you can do with what you have. Too.
Mm-hmm.
And if that involves, you know, just instilling the follow-up and evaluation mechanisms immediately so you're staying connected, it's a really important part of it, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, there's an interesting piece, and I don't know if NCA is looking at this piece, but, you know, the tendency for a teacher who touches climate change in school systems across the nation, for them to get challenged, attacked from a whole range of different people. It could be their colleague, it could be their department chair, their principal, the superintendent, elected officials, public officials, parents, even students.
Yeah.
It is very, I mean, you got to be a very strong teacher, very confident in what you're doing in order to, you know, step into that space. Sometimes it's non-controversial. Mm-hmm. And it's not controversial because of the science, it's controversial because of the social context. And that's what, and, you know, so I don't know if part of your teacher network is to have teachers share what worked, what didn't work, what strategies, to have, you know, a cohort of people who are having similar experiences. I mean, is that more what your network is for? I mean, what's the point of the network?
Yeah, that was actually...
No pressure.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't do that.
Oh, no.
Jeez,
worries,
Frank,
no.
You're making...
Pressure in my undergrad, I'm running away already. But,
yeah.
We actually, or Minda had sent out a survey to teachers within the NCSC network, and part of what they wanted was sort of a space to, like, share their stories and get advice, like, from other teachers on exactly that, like, what works and what doesn't work. So we're, that's definitely an aspect of what we're doing. And then also sort of vetting, like, different educational or, like, materials for them to use in different like activities that are online and such. So, well, it's still busy.
Well, what might be interesting in your configuration is that actually there are a lot of teacher networks by a lot of organizations, but yours seems to be a network that supports other networks because it's a common field-wide problem or challenge as opposed to a unique to any geographic network or a, you know what I mean? It's a pervasive thing. So it's,
yeah.
I would imagine leveraging or connecting to other networks that already exist would give you efficiency as opposed to building your own parallel network.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, I would imagine, Kristen, your teachers might be candidates for that value space.
Mm-hmm. I mean, partnering two small people, partnering to make a bigger project always is a nice thing. You divide and conquer the different parts of it. I would agree with that. I was going to comment on something and I forget. I'll say that there is interest in this kind of stuff, though, like being a part of a network, because a couple of years ago, the North American Association for Environmental Ed put out a call for people who are interested in joining a year-long, basically, network, professional learning community focused on climate change. And Karen was running it, and I think she had over 100 applicants and really wanted to focus on a group of, like, 25 to 30 people. And we accomplished a huge amount of work in that year, and it was nothing was paid for. I think you could get credit maybe for it if you wanted it, but it was just people that genuinely really wanted to learn. And a lot of those people were more in an informal space but of education, but I will say that I think there's teachers that would jump on the opportunity.
Yeah. We've had a pretty good testing response thing with our list of educators to see who would be interested in participating in that sort of thing. I was a little nervous because I was like, oh gosh, are we creating this network for no one to use? But definitely started to realize that there are a lot of people interested, so a lot of educators.
But it also raises the, you know, you have, there are a lot of listservs out there of networks. So NFTA has networks. The NFTA state chapters, I'm sure, have networks. Departments of Education at different levels have networks. Connecting to teachers is a really hard thing to do. We, as a former teacher, we don't make it easy for you to find out about us. And so I think, you know, spending some time on how to build awareness. Once you get the value proposition right, you know, then making them aware that this is out there if they need it, that's going to be tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. This is Jason Cervenek. Sorry, I've been kind of lurking in the background.
Lurking.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah, I know. One of those people. I think it's actually gotten a lot harder, too, because a lot of the networks that, you know, I was teaching for 11 years, and I've been at Bird now for 3. When I started the profession, you were kind of seeing a generational shift where, at least in Ohio, we had a science teachers organization that was very active. And there's kind of this gap between maybe the people that preceded me that went to those and subscribed to typical journals and the generation after me, where a lot of people were kind of, I wouldn't say shunning that, but almost going to online communities and online resources that were in various forms. And that's where they were getting the professional information. So I feel like there's more options out there, but it's also so fragmented, you don't have an easy way. You used to know what the go-to places were to hit biology teachers, and physics teachers maybe in chemistry are still there. But a lot of the other generalists in middle school, people could be in multiple organizations, or they might be in one, but they're still trying to get resources for a different content area, and it's not easy to figure out. You're using almost a shotgun approach from our perspective to hit the audiences. And as an educator, you're looking to all these different funnels of information coming down. But I think it's become a lot more fragmented.
Yeah, I would agree. We just the scattershot approach is a perfect description of how we do our summer institute outreach. It's like, okay, just what's everything? We like brainstorm lists and just Google places, you know, when it comes down to it. Jason, I really want to hear about your workshop. I want to go so badly, the argumentative writing one.
Yeah, we've got a lot of interest for it. We have people from, I think now, we've had somebody from Arizona get a hold of us, so we have a total of, I think, 25 people signed up from 4 different states, mostly Ohio.
Cool.
We were real lucky.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, there's so we were approached, that what really got this going is there's a colleague of mine who's now a vice principal at a high school. And a number of years ago, when we were working on some some educational initiatives in science, and she had just become a principal, I get this frantic text message one weekend, you have to read this book. And it was an English textbook for English teachers, and I was kind of puzzled, and I said, well, why? Why should I read this book? And she said, because all the inquiry and investigation we were doing in the science classroom, this explains how it could look in an English classroom. So I really trust this individual, so I went ahead and bought the book on Amazon that weekend and went through it in about 2 weeks. It was a very fast read. But the nice thing about that book is they spell out, it's Hillux, it's a professor at the University of Chicago who taught in Cleveland City Schools or Cleveland Heights for a few years. And he had just been doing work with his grad students going to Columbus or Chicago City Schools and doing outreach work with middle schoolers on argumentative writing. This really esoteric topic that was really old school rhetoric, but he'd figured out how to make it tangible. And so I read the book, thought it was fascinating because of the overlap with history and English and science. And at the same time, we've been running this one-day workshop on argumentative writing using these cold cases at our archives where students go through primary sources and have to build a claim, and they have to use evidence from those documents. They have to warrant it out. But we really weren't doing the warranting well. You know, so in science, you make a claim. We always talk about evidence, but very few people talk about, okay, what's the scientific principle that actually allows that evidence to back up that claim? It's this nuanced piece that I think as an educator, when you read something really well written, you know the warranting's there, but we never really teach it, and it cross-cuts all disciplines. So it's the idea that can you take evidence A and it really arrives at X, or it takes you somewhere else? And in a lot of the denial community, besides the logic fallacies, things like that, oftentimes the warranting is completely wrong. So there's evidence there, there's a claim, but the warranting is not based on the consensus of the scientific community. And you start to pick that apart. So we realized we had 3 different disciplines. We thought, what the heck? We cobbled together some money from a donation and a grant we had and ran this workshop doing history, science, social studies. Got really, really good feedback from people. It went exceedingly well. It's something that was it was really a guinea pig group, and we told them that. And we've had a lot of interest across the country from it. We were able to kind of collapse it down to 4 days with some time at the end for people to build their own cases, but we're really hitting on science, social studies, and English. So the workshop presents cases and examples that we put people in as a student and mesh them in the situation and kind of process it post-activity so they get a chance to see what it would be like from the student perspective.
It sounds so fun.
Yeah, it's a great group. It's been just kind of evolved organically as we've taken feedback and run with it.
What teachers, what disciplines are they all coming from different disciplines then?
Yeah, actually we have a very wide range. You know, we targeted the science community through our networks, but the 2 teachers that are facilitating quite a bit of it are from English Language Arts, so they have their own networks they reached out to. And then, you know, because it's involving our archives and our polar curator and the history professor that's running one of the day's workshops, we ended up pulling in that area. So I'd say it's right now about 50% science, 25% English, 25% history.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a nice mix because I think a lot of people appreciated the overlap. And it also scales really well there's ways to approach this with the middle school audience that's a little different than high school. And what you want to address is the same, but it's in more of a simplified fashion with not focusing on some of the nuance. So, you know, making a claim based on value judgments is a lot different than making a claim based on scientific evidence and warranting. So, you know, is somebody a hero is one of the activities. We're not going to do this one this summer. We took this one out. But, you know, if somebody's a hero, how do you entertain a discussion of what evidence would support that? Well, you'd first have to agree on what a hero is and have a robust discussion around that before people could ever even present evidence to support or refute. And then the warranting is really looking at the nuances of, you know, are you being bold and courageous? But if you're too bold and courageous, you're cavalier, and in which case you're not a hero. Somebody who's doing something in their everyday life that's just regular and uniform can't really be considered a heroic activity. Things that you can, and you look at it and you say, well, that seems a little esoteric, but if done well, and I think this speaks to what Frank said earlier, and done the right way, it's very nuanced but very deep. And when you talked about some of the district leaders with NGSS really not being prepared in leadership for these skills, we still fail to address the gap in PD and leadership training for teachers and helping them build their skill set and their professionalism, which is the thing the country always forgets. It's always more curricula, better books, better resources, but we forget about investing in the human capital, which is really the thing that enhances learning and stands the test of time. And we're hoping we've gotten a lot of great partnerships that have come out of this, and we've been able to field test some new stuff, trying to help people understand what argumentation looks like in science and how it's not just about creating a person that wants to go into the science profession, but can they read a newspaper article and say, okay, this is, or any piece of information, and say this is scientifically credible, or for some reason it's not. And that could be as simple
and
as
what?
Coming from, isn't The Onion? The Onion's not a credible source to get science information, or FIFA information for that matter. It's a great, anybody, if you want a great video on references, in The Onion, we actually have a case we've created with some documents from The Onion, because a lot of students don't necessarily know it's not a credible source, it's a humor one, to talk about it.
Oh, jeez.
I'd appreciate this. NOAA.
Oh, boy.
Concern for climate skeptics increasing over the next 50 years. And it actually sounds like a very credible study. And so we kind of slipped that in to see how students would respond to this thing from The Onion, where you don't have to know anything about what it says. You just have to know about the source. And it's just kind of an aha moment. And I think the FIFA thing makes it even easier to see, as you get this person from the council leading FIFA that is claiming the U.S. has two World Cups given in a given year to the U.S. And
right. And
he cites The Onion as the source for that information. And it's just a great example you can pull out and use in contemporary classrooms.
Well.
Yeah, so we're looking forward to it. It's probably one of the highlights of the summer.
Yeah, like I said, I looked at it a couple times. I have family in Cincinnati, and I was like, could I go? And, like, could I come out? Could I bring the kids? But no, I can't. It sounds awesome. What's the name of the book, though, that you sort of started it from? Can you share?
Yeah, the one, I really recommend it, is called Hillock's Argumentative Writing in K-12. Education. Let me actually pull it up on Amazon. It's actually gone up in price, I think. It was not a popular book at all, and all of a sudden, a lot of people are reading it now.
Well, argumentation has just become so big. How do you spell Hillocks?
It's Hillocks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Teaching Argumentative Writing, grade 6 through 12. The thing I love about the book, and it's the strong educators you've come across in your career, many of them were kind of drawn to think about the larger community by some student or colleague that said, you really have to share this. The introduction of the book is excellent. He says, you know, he had no aspirations to produce a nationally recognized book or to really commemorate this community of dialogue. He just had some good stuff that was working, and all his grad students saw it, like, every year. And finally, a few of them said, you got to put this on paper and publish it. And from there, the book kind of got a life of its own. It was just him putting his notes together, taking these activities they were using, writing them up. But it's ended up starting this huge – it's served as a platform for people to share good ideas across disciplines.
Cool.
And the book has so many examples of ways you can use it immediately. But he also has the theoretical backing for why in rhetoric – these elements are important, and it gives you some other books if you really want to hone your logic and reasoning skills you can pursue. I don't know. It's a good book.
My professor or my advisor in grad school was a rhetoric. He was a rhetorician in conservation biology. So I anytime I have a chance to go back into that world, I'm excited.
Well, you know, but I mean, I think we were talking about, you know, the teaching across the curriculum that is critical to climate and energy literacy at the beginning of the call. I mean, this is just another piece. It's not coming out of the social sciences. It's coming out of the humanities. And I think, you know, the longer I've been in this, the unfortunate STEM space, you know, because everybody keeps on adding a letter or changing a letter. Or, I mean, what they're doing is saying that, you know, there's another piece to that model that's important. So STEM, STEM, STEAM, STEAM, you know.
STEM.
You just keep going, right?
I haven't heard that one.
My favorite one is STREAM. You got to double
STREAM.
F, so you get science, because it's STREAM, right? Because you got to have writing and you got to have art. But the double F at the beginning is social studies and science. And then you're like,
uh-huh.
Wait a minute, that means all forms of education are important. Right? You know, you could put a double E for environmental and engineering. And then you're getting to a pretty silly state, which is an excellent education prepares you for the issues that we talk about here. And so, I mean, this is another fine example where there's a skill that is critical to what we're talking about that comes out of a non-science domain discipline that is absolutely critical to what we're talking about. And you know, so and it, I guess my charge for the next little while is to really call out the intersection of all forms of education as being critical pieces to preparing you for what we're dealing with climate change and the energy transformation. And, you know, it's all of it. It's not just, but it's all when it's done really well, like this book that, Jason, that you're sharing with us and the strategies that you're developing in those workshops. You know, that's very cool.
Yeah, it's trying to debunk that myth that if I talk faster and speak louder, that's sufficient evidence for my claim. And that fortunately, for society...
It's like when you go to a foreign country.
Yeah.
You just speak English louder, you know.
Sure, if I look at the news in the day, you know, louder and faster means I must be right.
Right.
Well, but, you know, persuasive, that's it. Persuasive, you know, when people speak in a very passionate, loud, authoritative way, if you don't know better, you could think that they know what they're talking about. And that argument structure tactic for debates works well as long as everybody doesn't have a clue as to what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You can gain the authority without actually having any substance. And that always gets us in trouble.
Right.
But I need to understand more about what warrant is. I don't understand that concept sufficiently. And please, you know, I think I have to read the book.
It's, you know, it's something that I had a lot of colleagues I used to teach with that said, darn it, this topic is so hard to talk about. And the book takes a series of, they're basically photographs, line art of crime scenes. And it asks you to make a matrix. And the first is, the claim is the last thing, but what's your evidence? Well, there's a body at the end of the stairs. There's photos disheveled. His clothes are disheveled. The carpets are disarrayed. There's something spilt on his jacket. That's all evidence. And the claim was, well, she murdered him. But the piece that's in between is, well, why does the disheveled photo on the wall say that he just didn't trip down the stairs? And the idea that you're going to bump the wall and that little piece, and I would say even in my own training, I really never thought about it that way. And all of a sudden you see it there and you're like, wow, it really is that simple. And there's certain key terms we put along with transitional words that give us the clues, but I'd never really consciously thought about it. And actually, I think it improved my own writing, having read the book. And then you think about the students going through the cadre of teachers we work with versus those that hadn't, and you just know that their writing ability of those students is going to be so much more robust, and their ability to be able to separate quality writing and fact from fiction is going to be so much more enhanced. And then you think about, if you can get other teachers in the school to do the same thing, then you have a really well, a student that's able to reason well not just in today's science, but whatever tomorrow science is that brings us.
I think, cool. Actually, Jason, that's a really, really, I mean, Joe Heimlich. I think you know him, Jason.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I remember mentioning him to you when last time I saw him in Maryland about this work, because one of the things he was pulling literature on, and I think he's still getting it back to me, is this idea of transferable skill, this idea that you have, what we're talking about are skills, but a lot of times the literature says if you build a skill related to some content as a vehicle for building the skill, you actually have to replicate that skill development with another content area in order to ensure that this is an enduring, transferable skill. Sometimes you isolate the skill with the content, and you're like, well, that skill is good for that content, but if I'm not in that content space, I don't use that skill. You don't actually see it as a transferable, more universal skill that applies to, you know, other things that don't have anything to do with it. So it's a you know, expansion on what you're talking about. I think that you probably already go there, but it's an interesting point. But skills, content issues, they're going to change. Skills are what sets you up to be, you know, nimble on regardless of the issues.
Well, and that's what we had a school group. We were field testing some stuff with, and I told their AP language class that one of the most important classes for science is what you're doing in your English class and being able to write and articulate and communicate. And for some of them, they were just kind of floored that, you know, as an educator, you hear this response every now and then, well, this is science class. My writing really doesn't matter. Well, no, if you can't articulate yourself, you're never going to publish, never get funded, and you're going to fall into these traps of reasoning. But it was kind of, for them, you could see Chris smiling at the back of the room, because he's been trying to reiterate this all year, but, you know, it's not the writing just itself, it's the reasoning you hone through the writing process. And they do a lot of, even in the workshops, there's a lot of time set aside for people to write, to get stuff on paper, to allow you to develop those thoughts more fully. And then we've all done this. I mean, we all know that as you write an idea up, even in draft form, it refines itself. There's a clarity that it brings to the process.
Yeah. Well, cool. I'm gonna cut this call off at 1:06.
One shameless plug I want to give, too. The Vatican will release the big encyclical in about 2 weeks on that is supposed to have a lot of environmental stuff, but also climate change initiatives, or speak to climate change. Interestingly enough, OSU was lucky enough to score a visit by the cardinal in charge of that document just below the Pope.
So
coming to Ohio State in October to do a very formal visit for 3 or 4 days in the city.
When is that?
Going to be the last weekend of October, the first weekend of November, and so it's the lead on Cardinal Turkson's the lead on the creation of that document, and he'll be speaking on both kind of environmental justice and climate change. So we feel very fortunate to have him this soon after the document is going to be released, and we have an extension agent and a faculty member that leads an initiative with extension work and outreach to faith communities. So he was able to arrange that.
Cool.
That's
so
awesome.
Kind of a neat discussion we're expecting over the next few months as that document gets released. We've already seen some responses to it, but
yeah, there's a whole lot of people who are taking that very. It's entering the public dialogue space in a very interesting way.
Yes.
Cool.
So, Kristen, before we jump into another thing, because, man, I could feel it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's
that? Thank you.
Yeah.
It would take the four of us much to get into another talk.
Right. All right. Well, good luck with your thing in July, Jason, and with your project at NCSC, and I'll see you next week, Frank.
Thank you.
See you next week.
See you guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.